Six Music.
This is a BBC Radio Six Music documentary.
She's Part of the fascination with today's guest is trying to find out where the political campaigner stops and the passionate musician starts. Bob Geldof's enduring legacy will always be the world-changing anti-poverty work that started with Band-Aid, but before then, he was an extremely successful musician fronting the Boomtown Rats in the late 70s and early 80s. As one of the most acclaimed bands of the post-punk era, they released a string of massive hits, including I Don't Like Mondays and Rat Trap, with Bob carving out a niche for himself as a driven and outspoken singer, something that's often overlooked. That's not to say on the first time we're going to ignore his charity work. His memories of writing Do They Know It's Christmas and his stories about tackling Margaret Thatcher are amazing, as you'll hear. But in the wake of the release of his first new album for a decade, what we try and do is trace the roots of his obsession with both music and human rights, which have existed within him for as long as he can remember. Today's guest is Sir Bob Geldof. So the first question that we ask everybody is, when were you first aware of music, even as a very small child?
5 or 6. In Cork, in summer's morning, about 11, in a big room. That's all I can remember. I can remember the smell of dust, and somebody put on an Elvis EP, and I particularly remember Teddy Bear and Don't Be Cruel.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of.
So it had a massive impact on you straight away.
It did, yeah, but my sisters were complete Cliff in the Shadows nuts. So they shared a bedroom and they had Cliff in the Shadows everywhere, like all over the roof, the ceiling and the walls and stuff. And I thought it was a bit Nancy-ish, you know, a bit girly, like living, I got myself a crying. But if you turn over onto the B-sides, they were fairly hardcore. I really mean that. I mean, you know, the Samuel Smith's guitar playing down was the first time I sort of heard what we now call rhythm and blues type guitar playing. And I like that. And the B-side, I think, of Living Doll was a track called Apron Strings, where he just does his 17-year-old or 18-year-old total Elvis impersonation. And it's full on. It's very good. Move It is full on.
Going to replace her. Alice, that could
I remember George Harrison saying, "No Shadows, no Beatles." And, you know, it's extraordinary to think that, because for British culture, Cliff and the Shadows were very important. And I was hauled along to the gigs at the Adelphi Cinema in Dublin. And in fact, even more remarkably, Lynn, my sister, woke me at 4:30 in the morning so that the two of us could go and stand outside the Ormond Hotel in Ormond Quay in Dublin, freezing, so we could glimpse Jet Harris in his leatherette coat leaving the hotel to go to the next gig. She was mad for us. He was sort of like a proto Billy Idol, wasn't he? He sort of, you know.
What about your first musical obsessions, your first single that belonged to you, maybe not your sister's? Maybe
my first single that belonged to me was Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys.
I love the colourful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations.
Good vibrations.
She's giving me the excitations. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up
she's by my excitation.
The sound, I guess, was just wonderful and beautiful. I never got into the Good Vibrations thing. I thought that was, you know, hippies, you know. But it was just too good. And possibly I had saved enough money. But more importantly, that prior to that, it was the Stones. And completely the Stones, utterly the Stones. I saw Bob Dylan, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones all in the same cinema in that year.
Where was that?
It was the Adelphi in Dublin. And my sister took me because I was too small to go on my own. The Beatles, I remember because it was just good. The Beatles were a boy band. It was like a girl thing. And I remember the heavy velvet drape curtains. Do you remember when curtains used to open in front of the cinema screen? And a pointed boot stuck out under the curtain. And the place just went ballistic, and I was one seat in from the aisle because my sister wouldn't let me stand on the aisle. And between the seats there was that green lino. Do you remember that marbled green lino? And the curtains opens and they start with dang, dang, dang. What's that? I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I was really, I don't know if I was afraid, or I think I was a little frightened, because the noise of 2,000 women. And I looked behind, my sister was going mad, even though she kind of resented the Beatles for taking Cliff's crown. she was going ballistic, and I looked behind her as she leant forward, you know, grasping for, you know, George or whatever. And I looked down at the green marble lino and saw these rivulets of female piss streaming down the aisles, forming little banks, you know, of dirt.
So that's not a myth, that's actually true. That did actually happen. But the Stones was more your thing. What was the Stones track that maybe steeled your resolve to maybe become a musician, that inspired you?
It was such a racket, such a glorious racket. It seemed to be wild. And I'm trying to find an equivalent for, you know, a contemporary audience. I guess when you heard the Sex Pistols first or something like that, it seemed to be very, very dangerous. This sounded like a bit out of control. You know, moving in some way, which I now understand was sexual, but back then I just thought, great. But you must understand that I'm not very good looking anyway, but I mean, when I was a little boy, or well, becoming a little boy to a teenager, when you're all gawky and gangly and a mess, my nose was just as big as it is now. I still had bags under my eyes, had that floppy, droopy lips, and my hair was a mess like now. But suddenly Mick comes along, and it isn't the worst thing in the world to look such a complete arse, you know. And so, you know, when pulling age came in, I could kind of get away a bit with that sort of Stones look. And they didn't wear suits. This was a major thing for me. They wore jumpers, you know, and I remember the talking to you now, I can absolutely remember the jumpers. And he didn't move. He just stood there, you know, and he just stared. And I remember again the first gig I saw, again with Lynn, my sister, and they started with Everybody Needs Somebody, like, you know, and he'd come out at the point where it says, and I need you, 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 and he'd point at a girl in the front row, she'd collapse, and he'd just go along the front row and you'd go, dum, 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 I need you, 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 and they'd just fall over and be carried out. And it was so exciting. And they looked so odd. They looked like, do you remember Bratz, those dolls? You know, you had Barbie and you had Bratz with big heads. That's what they looked like. And, you know, I'm very lucky in my life. I get to meet people that I think are great. And oddly, sometimes I become their friends. I'm sort of friends with a lot of them now. But if you see the Rolling Stones together, they are tiny. I mean, beyond tiny. Tiny waists, that post-war impoverished, you know, sort of thing. No diet, so we didn't grow up. We never developed a hip. And their heads are gigantic with hair, you know. They're like Brad, like a bunch of those Bratz dolls. And that's what they looked like then. And so, like, nothing. Everything about them was a giant upraised index finger. Everything. And they're my boys.
What was your first band like? Your very first band?
That was it, really. I mean, it was the Rats. There was a feeble attempt in school. There was a guy called Brendan King who sat behind me in history, and I didn't participate in school. I didn't participate in sports or the stuff. I was in the debating society, but I wasn't allowed to go on away matches to other schools because I wouldn't wear the school blazer and that stuff. So, but they knew that I was very interested in the blues because Mick and Keith used to say, forget us, go and listen to Muddy Waters. And specifically Muddy, they used to say, and go and listen to Howling Wolf. And those names, it wasn't fun in my house at that time, and it wasn't fun in Ireland at that time. And so Radio Luxembourg, which people of my generation go on about, but you must understand, was this thin electric line, just about audible, that connected this solitary little island in the mid-Atlantic to the rest of the world. Up to then, Ireland sort of was contained in sort of Kulturkampf, which was imposed, that you had to learn the Irish language, you had to appreciate Irish music and Irish dancing, and of course we all rejected that as a result. And suddenly, you know, crackling in from this small comes Tony Prince and those people playing these tracks. And literally it was like an oxygen tank, because I started developing asthma at 11, and here were these boys and girls talking of other universes, other possibilities, the not only the desire for change, but the articulation of change and the necessity for change. And this is how you do it. You play this radical music with this radical intent, with this radical lyric. That's what you do. And we didn't have telly or stuff, so I just sat there reading books and imbibing this. And for all the things I couldn't articulate at 11 and 12, they were doing it for me. And so when Dylan said, listen to Woody Guthrie, and when Mick said, no, it's not us, it's Howlin' Wolf, I dutifully went to the record shop, Murray's Record Centre, and said, have you heard of these people? And sitting at home by yourself, and you hear the name Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and you think, are they names or are they expressions? And that somebody could be called Howlin' Wolf. You know, you kind of go, wow. I listened to that music and I adored its primitivism, because pop was fairly primitive still. And I joined the Irish Blues Appreciation Society. I was 0011.
And, of how many?
13. And some blues guys used to visit, and they played in a pub, Slattery's in Capel Street. And I had an NSU quickly. And I'd go into then one evening, one drunk night, I lurched forward, stumbling towards this bemused, what I thought ancient, black geezer who was called John Lee Hooker, and drunkenly leant over his shoulder. Hey, you're all right there, you're all right, waving this harmonica. And this bemused guy is staring at me. I was going, woo, go on there, John, you're fine there now, you know, come back, you know, boom, 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 boom. Shut up! So that was it. And it was the Stones, it was Dylan in a nutshell. Then The Who. I mean, peak to me was the stuff he said, the stuff he talked about. So sharp and looking sharp. And
so that made an impact on you as well, the fact he was such a verbose, articulate guy with such... an ability
he understood what
to communicate.
Yeah, and this is what we're doing. You mightn't get it, but this is why and this is what.
Take your money!
1977, Looking After Number One was the first Boomtown Rats single.
Yep.
Always a big deal in a band's career, including your first single. What do you remember from that?
The best thing about it was that it appeared first on a sampler album. Do you remember samplers? The sampler, I think it was called New Wave 77. It was just red cover. And there were a couple of bands making their debut. The Rats, the Ramones, Blondie, Richard Hell, Patti Smith, The Damned. I'd never heard those, and obviously nobody else had, because this was their thing. The Rats got the reviews from that album. You know, the music papers said, you know, this is a great, this track Looking After Number One. Prior to that, John Peel had offered to sign the Rats onto his own label. And there was a song that we'd recorded called She's Gonna Do You In, and he loved that. He wanted to put that out as a single. And there was a new record label had just started called Stiff. And we knew the guy who started that, Dave Robinson. He was a Paddy. So Dave listened to the demos and he wanted to sign the demos to Stiff. But it was a new label. And, you know, I was sort of hoping for better things. And then Phil Linnett from Thin Lizzy got us in to see Phonogram. And Nigel Grange, who subsequently signed the Waterboys and Sinead, he'd signed The Boys Are Back in Town, he'd signed I'm Not in Love by Tenth, he'd signed all those. He loved the band, was going to start his own little label, and said, will you come with me, I'll sign you. So that was kind of what happened. But for some reason, Looking After Number One was picked by Phonogram to go out on this sampler. And because it got all the reviews, that then became the single. And it went into the charts, and I'm sure lots of people say this. I mean, when people say, what was the best day of your life sort of thing, that was certainly one of them. To be in the British charts, to be so obsessed with that stuff up to that point, as you've heard me crap on about. And there you are.
Rat Trap was the first number one that you had. Pretty damning account of someone's relationship with their hometown. Did you feel that way about where you came from?
Yeah. I mean, I was working in an abattoir, and it was about a kid called Paul there who used to... I was frightened of him and them. I was a South Dublin middle-class boy, and he used to carry an axe in his waistband. He goes, "Here, what's it going, Bob?" I'd say, "Yeah, very nice, Paul, yeah." He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Well, did you have a good weekend, dude?" And he'd say, "Oh, yeah." He said, "I had a three-stitcher." A three-stitcher was when he got in a fight and he could smack somebody with his axe. And, you know, he then followed it up to find out how many stitches had to be imposed on this person's head. And so that was him, and Billy just scanned more.
There was a lot of rotting going on that night. Cruising time for the young bright lights. Just down past the gas house by the meat factory door, the Five Lamb boys were coming on strong. The Saturday night city beat had already started, and the pulse of the corner boys just sprang into action. And young Billy watched under the yellow street light and said, "Tonight, up all night, it's gonna be a light night." Billy don't like it living here in this town, he said. Traps have been sprung long before he was born, he said. Hope as the dust behind all the closed doors, and puss and grime ooze from its scabrous and sword. The screaming and crying in the high-rise block, it's a rat trap, Billy, but you're already caught. Hey, you can make it if you wanna, or you need it bad enough. You're young and good-looking and you're acting kinda dumb. Anyway, it's Saturday night time to see what's going down. Put on the right suit, ready, head for the right side of town. It's only 8 o'clock, but you're already.
BBC Six Music.
Sitting in the front row, maybe in the bottom, turning on the
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, where we trace the musical lives of some of the most significant figures in popular music, and my guest this week is Sir Bob Geldof. Well, Bob found fame for his role as a human rights activist following his split from the Boomtown Rats. The roots of his desire to help people started long before he joined a band. I asked him about the first time he got involved with a charity.
You have to understand, I mean, you know, this is boring, but you have to understand, like, what was happening. Shay Geldof. My mum died at 7. My dad sold towels around the countryside of Ireland. So every Monday he'd leave and come back on Friday, which left me and my sisters to our own devices. And it was a very old, tall Victorian house. And we let most of it out in bedsits because my dad wasn't making much money selling his towels. My eldest sister was supposed to look after us, and she got fed up with that at 17. She was about 17. And she bailed quickly. She married a cop. And then my middle sister was the sort of family swat. She was the first and only girl, I think, to go to college. She stayed in school late because there was no point in coming home. So I was 7 or 8, and I'd sort of come home from school and light the fire and you know, make my tea. And there wasn't a telly because there was no money in that, but I don't think there was telly anyway in those days. And listen to the wireless and read books, because that was it. Didn't do any homework. There was no one there to make me do it. So it was crap. I mean, you know, loads of people have far worse lives than mine, but you live the life you're given. And it wasn't that I was self-pitying. It's just that, you know, your mates were going home and the dinner was there and, you know, there was people to talk to. So when I'd go to their place, I'd think, this is nicer. But I didn't dwell in it. I mean, kids are survival organisms. You just get on with it. So I got on with it. But so when music happened, there's no one to talk to. There's no one to sort of try and put a frame of reference around what you're doing. And suddenly, here's this stuff that's saying what you're feeling. And I think, because I've been asked a lot about it, given that a child only knows authority and trusts it, and the ultimate authority are your parents, should those parents bail, my mother by dying, not her fault, my dad by having to go to work, not his fault, but they ain't there. So should they not be there? Should they abrogate their responsibility? Should they not, in your view, take care of you, though you're not aware of that? Why should you trust any authority, lesser authorities like your teachers or priests and certainly the police? Why should you bother? They're not to be trusted. They go away. They disappear. The ones who are supposed to take care don't. So I think that was it. And when I was reading, I was very sick at 11. And it took 3 days for my sister to discover I was even in the house. So I was there because she'd get up, we'd make breakfast and leave for school at different times. I was reading books that were The Romance of Poverty, Steinbeck, Studs Terkel, the great Chicago journalist. There's nothing romantic about poverty at all. But Woody Guthrie's Bound for Glory, from which I took the name the Boomtown Rats. Because they were resonant with the music I was hearing. And as I got older, I began to read about other things. For some reason, I was reading about Africa. I was reading about South Africa. And it just struck me as implausible, as utterly intellectually absurd, that someone was considered less by virtue of the fact that they wore a crap jumper or they had a terrible moustache or favoured a different football club or political party or because their skin was a different colour. That struck me as being so implausibly, intellectually ludicrous that you are less because your skin just isn't. If that was the case, and somebody with a redder skin than mine would be disenfranchised as well. It's ridiculous. And it struck me as that. Like, just, I had to reread some things about South Africa because I couldn't believe how preposterous to base an entire political idea upon. Now, I know that sounds like grand, but that's what it struck me. So me and my mate Mick Foley started the anti-apartheid thing in South Dublin, very grandly. We started in school, and I think it was 13 with Mick. Mick became a journalist. And And then I kind of think maybe it was a pulling technique. Because if you remember the sort of those anti-apartheid badges was sort of yin-yang, black and white with AA. And like CND badges, they were quite cool. And I could go, yo, baby, you want one of these little buttons? I'm the guy, you know. Meanwhile, I looked a complete ugly shambles. So it didn't work at all. But, you know, it kind of worked. That thing grew quite a lot. So being by yourself when you're a kid, you learn a couple of things. Of course, you learn independence. You have no option. But you also learn organisation. Because who else does the shopping? Who else orders the coal for the fire? Who else does the cooking? You know, so you do. So you become organised. But the last thing really a 8-year-old does is take his shirts and undies and socks down to the laundrette. Or gets his hair cut, and so here I am. And, you know, that's kind of it. And the next thing that happened was, because there was no one at home to make me do any homework, I just, at 13, 14, didn't want to go home. It was a cold house. I didn't want to go down to the basement and put the coal in the yellow bucket and make the fire and boil the rice. I didn't want to. So I'd hang around school a bit later, and then I'd go into Dublin, central Dublin, and I hooked up with a crowd called the Simon Community, who sound religious but aren't. And they used to work with homeless people and hookers and dispossessed men. And I suppose we call them bag ladies, schizophrenics. And they would impose no moral agenda. They would simply give them soup and befriend them. And so we'd collect groceries, vegetables, free from the grocer shops at about 6:30 because they hadn't sold, so they'd give us the ones that hadn't sold. About 2 a.m, the bakers would start producing the first loaves of bread for the day and deliver to the hotel, so they'd give us extra. And we'd go around and we'd make a fire in Smithfield Market, a big fire, and we'd make soup out of this stuff. And the drunks would shamble in and the hookers would sit around, and these weren't the glamorous girls of the TV and movies. These were thin, pinched, whey-faced, bruised, small little girls. And I often saw these thuggish pimps, again in their plastic leatherette coats, far more interesting than anything, of course, that was happening at school. In fact, I found them living novels. I found them to be John Steinbeck. I found them to be Studs Terkel. I found them to be Irish avatars of Woody Guthrie. And but it was real and not romantic at all. And we'd make flasks of soup and we'd have our rounds and we'd go and talk to the old bag ladies asleep in the porches of their houses and stuff like that. So it was never about charity. It was about this not being right, that this can change, that it doesn't have to be that way, that you can talk about that through this very thin, minor, little art form called pop music. And even if you couldn't write about it yourself, you could certainly find it articulated. And I'm old now. And I miss that in pop, that vitality of now, where people define and articulate things you see but haven't considered. And you hear it in a 3-minute pop song and it slaps you in the face and you go, yeah, exactly like the impact of, say, Anarchy in the UK or Smells Like Teen Spirit. And I guess for some of the hip-hop people in the beginning, that's what it was. But for your standard rock and roll, I miss that. I miss that keen observation and identification and articulation. And in some ways, it's of a little importance because the job of, this word sounds really crap, the job of, say, an artist or a songwriter, I think, without them realising it, is to articulate that which society is thinking before society knows it's thinking it. And so when you hear it, it's so fresh. You go, absolutely. And that becomes a hit record.
It's Christmas time. There's no need to be afraid. At Christmas time, we let in light and we banish shame. And in our world of plenty, we can spread a smile of joy. Throw your arms around the world at Christmas time.
Can you remember getting the first check after Band-Aid? The first check to the post when the royalties and the money started coming in?
Well, I didn't get it. I mean, we'd set up the Band-Aid Trust, and John Kennedy, who had been the house lawyer of Phonogram, subsequently its president, Universal, still my friend, still the lawyer for Band-Aid, my consigliere, you know, really. He said he'd just deal with it. You need to set up a trust fund. I'll deal with it. He was in the room when I went in to see the MD of Phonogram. And we had the check long before the record came, because we did a publishing deal. Midge and I assigned over our rights to the organisation. For me it was get in, get out. That's the most I can do. And with the publishing, Kennedy just said, we want an advance on this. And said, you know, what are you talking about? And he said, 3 million. Something like that, you know. And I was going, yeah, go, you know, dude, you know. And he did, like, he drove amazing deals. Johnny Waller, Tony Powell, these people at Phonogram. You know, it was instant. I mean, I know it's like some, you know, Mickey Rooney sort of thing. Hey, let's do a concert. You know, I don't think there was a band who were difficult. You two were a bit difficult, but certainly Sting and Le Bon and Kemp and, you know, obviously Midge. I mean, without Midge, it really didn't happen. That's the truth. He said, look, I'll do something, you do something, I'll give you a call. So he sent me over this thing, do, 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 do. So I rang him, I said, it's from Zed Cars, you know, which was an old police thing, you know. So I had a song that the Rats had rejected called It's My World. The opening line was, it's my world, there's no need to be afraid. And in the cab over to my mate's house, who was ill, I was visiting him, and I wrote, it's Christmas time, there's no need to be afraid. And I really dashed out the words in the cab, played it to my friend Cooker on his flu bed, just shambly trying to remember the chords of the song, It's My World. And then went up to Midge's, and because I hadn't quite defined my part of the tune, I was sort of playing the chords, and he said, do you keep playing different versions? I said, I know. Like, he said, well, just do one version into the mic, and I sort of shambled through it. And he went, okay, leave it to me. then I went up to her, and literally then the next day we sat opposite each other and worked out the middle part and the Feed the World, Do They Know It's Christmas. And I think Feed the World was my bit because I had very much in my mind to do a John Lennon empirical message song, Happy Christmas, War Is Over, Give Peace a Chance, you know, those message songs, say it absolutely directly. And so I said Feed the World, and then Midge must have said, you know, Do They Know It's Christmas. That must be how it worked. But it was facing each other, and, you know, as per you often read about and with other people. I then left to organise the guys and the studio, and he just got on with it. And Weller went up to put down some guitars. Taylor from Duran went up to put down some bass. I started calling around. Everyone said, yeah. McGuinness was a bit iffy about U2. They hadn't quite crested now. They were a happening band, but not quite there. But they really worked out every move they would make to get there. Really, it was called the Comintern, you know. They used to sit down and work, still do, work out, you know. And they weren't sure whether this was cool or naff. So when push came to shove and they saw the name of everyone who was doing it, which was everyone in that period, you know, said, yeah, okay, you know. And then, of course, Bono nails it with that great vocal. It was odd in the studio that day, but good. And so that was it. And then Kennedy really organised the business end of it, the trust. And, you know, I thought 100,000 albums. I said to Waller and Tony Powell, please get it out before Christmas. Please. You know, that's where it'll resonate. And they just got the factories to work 24 hours. And the workers worked through the night in overtime and all weekend for free. Isn't that exceptional? I mean, can you imagine? And all of Europe, all the pressing plants in Europe only pressed one record, that, because the demand was so intense. And, you know, I was free, you know, I thought, what? And there were queues, you know, I saw queues in Oxford Street and people bought 40 and gave back 39 to the cashier to resell. And weird. And I remember Fortnum's ringing. I said, how exactly does one sell a pop single? And I said, well, you order it, kind of. And I saw a picture of a butcher in Eastbourne. And in his Christmas window were, you know, suckling pigs, geese, turkeys, and a line of Band-Aid singles. He was selling them. And I don't know what happened.
Can you remember the first world leader you really locked horns with?
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher. It was sort of, we were engaged anyway. I mean, you know, there's whole generations have happened since, but I mean, there's a VAT on records. And given that everybody was doing as I've described with this record, the tabloids started saying, why is the government taking tax? So it became an issue. Neil Kinnock was head of the Labour Party and he wrote to me and he said, Bob, do you want me to raise it in Parliament? Which is very delicate of him because he could have done without that. I said, don't make it a left or right argument. It's not above that. This rises above an argument. We can all agree, despite our political stripe, that this is a serious aberration. And I'm being polite here. And he said, fine. So what Kinnock went and did was write a letter and gather all living prime ministers, and there were many alive then, Macmillan was alive and all that, and get them to sign it. So Tory and Labour, and said to Thatcher, saying, what are you doing? There was a kid in Parliament, he had just 3 months in Parliament, his name was Blair, and he wrote and said, could he start the Band-Aid Parliamentary Committee? So I bumped into her at a do, and I was quite aware the cameras suddenly pushed everyone aside and jostled. I was quite amazed that she was relatively small. So I moved in very close to her to make her look even smaller, and I sort of loom. And I look down and she's, you know, and she's sort of, hold on, I've seen him on telly. Oh, this is the trouble, you know. And she said, Mr. Geldof, we're very proud of, you know. And I said, Prime Minister, can I talk to you about this? I read what you said. And in those days, I'd be boring here. There's an anomaly in the European market called the Common Agricultural Policy, where 49% of all our European taxes that we pay and everyone pays goes to subsidising our farmers. There's no need for that. It's a nonsense. But what it does, it builds up surplus food. In those days, we had wine lakes and wheat mountains and butter hills. And we spent taxes to grow the food we didn't need, would never need, further taxes to store it, and most obscenely, more taxes to destroy it. Meanwhile, 8 miles south of our continent, 8 miles south, that's the gap between the richest continent, Europe, and the poorest Africa, 8 miles, 30 million people were dying every night on our television screens. I said to her, why can't we, you know, take the butter mountain, instead of destroying it, move it south as emergency aid? And she said, she made the argument that they can't just eat butter. But you see, I knew they could take a derivative of that. And she said, it's not as simple as that. And I said, no, Prime Minister, there's nothing as simple as dying. And, you know, that was on the news. And so she gave me the glare. I mean, it really was like this Medusa stare, you know. And but we sat back to back at the lunch. About halfway through, she turned around, tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around, and there was Margaret Thatcher, and she said, Mr. Gulliff. And I said, yes, Prime Minister. And she said, come and see me. So that was the first time I was at number 10. And I was in a couple of times after that, and I used to bring my dog Growler with me, who was a Yorkshire Terrier, because there was no one to look after him. So I'd cycle in and put him in a basket. But I did it on purpose, because I knew it would diffuse.
When did you first decide to get back into the studio again?
I don't decide, you know. I mean, there's no purposeful gap. It's when the urge comes, it's an urge. You just say, oh, yeah. That you pick up the guitar daily and you're doing tunes, that, but suddenly, like, you know, you're just noodling, and that noodling makes musical sense, and you follow the logic of it, and so you go, hold on, it's tune time, and then whatever's been going on in your subconscious starts coming very easily, just one and one, two, three, four, five, six, in the end it's 31 in my case. And I go up to Pete's place, who was the bass player in the Rats. I wrote Like Clockwork with him and a few other songs during the Rats. He's always played with me in the solo bands. He's a producer himself, you know, had quite a lot of hits with other people. And I go up to his bedroom, and he's got kit up there. I just put it down. He messes with it. And it just builds up into something. But the only thing you can be sure of is that there's a need, or else it wouldn't occur.
Had all these firsts all the way through it. It's time for you to pick the last song that we're going to play.
I like Blowfish. I'll tell you why. Captain Beefheart came to play with the Rats in California, and I loved Captain Beefheart. And you know, we had this. I wanted this to be sort of. I wanted the album, I thought, to be Led Zeppelin-y. You know, that's what I thought. And we were doing Blowfish, Pete and I did, and he looped stuff, and it was really good. And I just was singing wildly, you know, into it. And I think I was playing harmonica, I thought the overall vibe was Captain Beefheart. And that must have been in my head, because the classic Beefheart album is Trout Mask Replica. So I just started singing. I've been, you know, drinking like a blowfish. Drinking till my stomach's dry. I said to Pete, was looking at me, I said, I'll leave it, it'll be fine. And then I've been eating like a monkfish, you know, just a little feeds my soul. I don't have a clue what it's about. Come, you know, actually properly recording, I was writing these deeply meaningful words. And I said, do you really object to those blowfish words? And he said, no, they sound all right to me. And I said, well, you never listen to lyrics. He goes, that's true. So I said, let's just leave it with the blowfish thing. And I love it. I love the sort of the early Who bass on and stuff. So, yeah. I think a noisy one, Blowfish, you know, it'll put people off buying the record. Any bloody possibility of buying a record.
BBC Radio.
Six music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.
Do you remember a time when you were a girl from Mars? I don't know if you knew that. Oh, it's there, they're playing cards and you were into men's cigars. And she never told me her name. I still love you, the girl from Mars. On a cool summer night, fireflies and stars.